How Yoga Works. Chapter 1. The Place We All Start From. It was just another one of those dusty little Indian towns. No sign before, no way even to know what they call it. The road just starts to get wider, and you see more people on it. And then suddenly the wild green of the jungle ends, and then you spot the first little houses of brown mud brick. And then you're in the little stream of farmers and women carrying water clay jugs on their heads and cows and pigs and chickens all headed for the middle of town. We came to a stout wood pole stretched across the road about waist high. There was a little guardhouse set up on the side with a bored policeman leaning out a small window in the heat of the sun and the dust of the road. Long Life and I had seen dozens of little checkpoints like this in the past year. The police were supposed to catch people poaching wood or wild animals from the jungle, which was the property of whatever little local tyrant called himself king. Mostly, though, the police simply took the opportunity to force bribes out of traveling merchants. People and animals just came up to the pole and ducked under and went on, and so Long Life and I did that too. It was easier for Long Life. You see, he's a little Tibetan moustache dog, just about as high as your ankles. As we went under, the policeman stepped out. He leaned over lazily and picked up a stone and threw it at Long Life, who was used to this greeting in India, and dodged it easily. But I was tired and hot, and I threw an insolent glance at the man as I collected Long Life into my arms. "You!" he called. I walked on without a pause, something my grandmother had taught me. You could always say you hadn't heard. "You! There! Stop!" And then the sound of the lathi tapped on the ground. The lathi is a strong, flexible, wicked wooden stick. If you put one end on the ground, the other comes up to about your waist, and all the policemen carry one. It doesn't look like much, but in the right hands, it can lay your skin open in a minute. And some of these men I knew were really looking for an excuse to use it. So I stopped. "Come back here," I turned and looked in his face, dark with hours in the sun, dark with an evil temper, and something else. I walked back slowly, trying to look calm. "Into the guardhouse," he ordered, pointing with his stick. It was hardly big enough for a single person, the guardhouse, let alone the two of us. But better not to fight. The fingers around the stick were tensed. He pushed in after me, too close. And then I knew what it was about him. He had that sweet stench of a man who drank too much of the local sugarcane liquor. He leered at me with his bloodshot eyes up and down the simple pink-hued orange of the light cotton sari that I wore. I'd traded for my warm mountain woolens nearly a year ago. "You're not from around here," he said, almost accusing me. "No, sir, I am not." "Then where are you from?" "From Tibet," I said. He looked at me blankly. "The snow mountains," I added, pointing vaguely off to the north. He nodded, but his eyes were already down, crudely across my chest, and then to Long Life, and then to my red woolen bag. "What's in the bag?" he said. Again, the policeman's accusation. I'd heard it 100 times. The preliminary to demanding a bribe. I was in no mood. "Nothing of value," I replied, trying to inch a little further back from his body and his stink. "Open it," he ordered, pointing to a little shelf at the window near our elbows. I gave him one hard glance and silently set my things out on the shelf. All my things in the world. A shawl from Katrine, a small wooden bowl, and the book, wrapped against the weather. "Open it," he demanded, pointing to the book. I opened the wrapping, and he leaned over the ancient pages as if to read them. They were upside down. "It's old," he declared, standing straight again, glaring into my eyes. "It is," I said simply. "Where did you get it?" "My teacher gave it to me," I replied. He looked in my face again. "Your teacher?" he said in disbelief. "My teacher," I repeated. "Put it back," he said, waving to the book and my things. I collected them slowly, trying not to let him see that my hands were shaking. I looked past him, out the door. "Then may I go, sir?" He took the bag from my hands. "You will come with me," and he turned and walked down the road to the town. I followed behind, my heart pounding and Long Life pressed to my chest. In about half an hour, the man turned off the road into a dusty little yard. At the back there was a dirty, shabby building of the same dull brown mud brick. It had a porch with a thatched palm cover fallen down on one side, thick with the hot, dry dirt of the yard. At the very top of the building, scratched across the mud, was the face of a lion with two swords crossed below it. Sign of the local king, I thought to myself. They're all pretty much the same. At least he hadn't taken me home. Maybe I could talk to someone higher up, someone who wasn't drunk. The dark man stepped to the side and pointed to the door with his stick. Inside, he grunted. I held up my skirt, stepped across the dirt piled up on the porch, and then through a small door. Sit down, he said, pointing to a little wooden bench against the wall. He turned into a doorway opposite the bench. I could hear him talking to someone there in low tones. I surveyed the little police station, the jail, for now I could see what it was. I sat in a largish room. The back was divided into three crude cells in the same mud brick. The front of each cell was open to view, with stout bamboo bars from ceiling to floor and a little door of the same material. Two cells were empty, but in the one to the right there was a figure lying face down on the bare floor. The wall across from me had a rack of old, rusty swords and spears, locked across with a bar. The real weapons for major trouble, something this town has probably never seen. And then two small rooms behind where I was sitting. And that was it. My eyes returned to the floor and the same piles of dirt. The policeman came back out. Come, he ordered again, pointing to the door behind him. I entered with an uneasy feeling, clutching Long Life tightly. Sit down, he said again, pointing this time to a grass mat on the floor. The captain wants to talk with you. Wait. And he was gone, and the door was closed. I sat and looked at the captain. He was seated on a thicker mat and cushions at the head of the room, bent over a low table covered with papers, seeming to be quite occupied writing something out with a bamboo pen. But I knew his little bureaucrat's trick. He would let me wait until he was sure I was uncomfortable before he even acknowledged that I was there. It was a way of saying that I was beneath his notice. And so I took the time to study the room, and the captain too. He was surrounded in disorder, stacks of ledgers and papers, everything covered with the same brown dust. The only light was from small windows across the door, but the afternoon sun lay across him and his work. I guessed he was about 35, the career public servant type, settled into his middle age. I think at one time he must have been handsome. He had thick black hair coming out in little curls, but peppered now with gray. Too early for gray, I thought. When he looked to the side and checked some list of things, I could see him flinch slightly. With that and his stooped shoulders, I guess he had hurt his back from years of sitting like this in his office, hunched over reports. His face had been strong, I think, almost noble, but now it was marred by lines of pain cutting down between his eyebrows and crossing the corners of his mouth. His cheeks had gone a little puffy, and there were bags under his eyes, probably having trouble sleeping. With the pain in the back, and some other pain, too, something in his heart, I thought. And then, not to seem too forward, I lowered my eyes again and waited, as a woman in those times was expected to do. Finally, he set his pen down and covered his ink pot and raised his eyes to me with steadiness of authority. The sergeant says I should waste my time questioning a girl with a book, he sighed. I looked up and gazed into his face. It was not an unkind face, but it was the face of someone in pain, and so I thought it better to be quiet. There was a pause, and in that one moment I felt him ready to send me on my way. I looked to the door, and he seemed to hesitate. But then when I looked back, he was studying my face as if I were someone he might have known. And then he looked down for a moment and set his hand on the little writing desk. Come here, closer. Show me the book. I moved up across from him, took the book from the bag, and set it on the desk. I went to open it, but his hands were already there, strong, handsome hands, and he unwrapped it with a quick gesture. He knew about books. The sergeant was right, he nodded. It is an old book, letters scratched into palm leaf. I nodded, my heart sinking. How did you get this book? He said, looking stern now into my face. My teacher gave it to me. Teacher? What kind of teacher? The one, sir, and now I knew it could be trouble, but as always, I knew it better to be honest. The one who taught it to me.
Taught it to you?
Yes, sir.
To you, a girl? How old are you?
17, sir. And you have studied a book like this?
I have, I replied, raising my head with some pride, as my grandmother would have.
Where? In my own country, in Tibet.
And that is where your teacher is?
Yes, sir,
or what?
Where my teacher was.
Oh, he is dead?
My teacher is... Oh, however could he understand? My teacher is gone.
Gone? He said, staring at me now, alert, sensing my hesitation.
Yes, sir, I said, settling back, staring, starting to really worry now.
And then why have you come to India?
I'm traveling to the Ganges River, to Varanasi, to study further there.
Study? A girl?
Study with whom?
With a teacher there, I replied lamely.
What teacher? What is his name?
I don't know.
Don't know?
How will you find him?
Or her, I thought, but all I could do was shake my head. He was searching my face again.
How long have you been traveling?
I looked up at the ceiling and counted the months.
A year, almost exactly a year.
And what does your husband think of this?
I have no husband.
Your father, then?
My father knows I have come to India.
Knows, but doesn't approve, he retorted, and all I could do was look at the floor.
The captain sighed again and ran his finger along the title of the book. I could see his lips moving, working out the sound of the Sanskrit, the mother tongue, written there.
And so he can read it, I thought, but only barely, only just the sounds.
This is the Yoga Sutra, he said softly, the great mother of all teachings on yoga.
I nodded.
And you know it? Do you know it well?
I nodded again.
He straightened up suddenly in his seat, and I saw him wince again,
so used to it that he had not even been aware he had winced.
Imagine how it all sounds to me, he said. A girl, your age, claiming to know a book like this, a priceless book, learned from a missing teacher and wandering around a foreign country with no husband, without her father's permission, headed for a teacher with no name. And if the sergeant is to be believed, without a penny in your possession.
I nodded. This was the sum of my life.
And so you swear the book is your own? You have not stolen it?
It is mine.
He sighed again, heavily, and then suddenly turned the book around towards me.
He flipped through several palm leaf pages and pulled them off, then stabbed his finger at a page.
Here then, read to me what this says, right here.
I leaned over the desk. It is from the second chapter, I began, and it says, things that cannot last seem to us as if they will.
The captain's eyes suddenly dropped and stayed there for a moment. When he looked up, they were glistening as though he were about to cry. And there was an anger, or perhaps anguish, in his voice.
What does it mean? He demanded.
It's talking about our lives, I replied quietly. Our friends, our family, our work, our own bodies. When they are here, in front of us, when they can see us, when we can see them and touch them, it seems as though they will always be there. But then they always leave us.
His face tightened. That's not what it says.
It is most certainly exactly what it says, sir.
You are lying. You're just making something up trying to get away with this thing you have stolen.
But that is not the book. It's not what it says. This is a book about yoga, the greatest book of yoga. And yoga is, well, you know, exercises, things you do, special exercises to get healthy and fix problems like with your body. And he leaned toward me intensely, and it made him wince again, still unaware of it.
That is what it says, I repeated.
The captain glared at me and closed the book. I reached out to wrap it, but his hand came down on the pages hard.
I will keep this, he said flatly.
But I need it.
Maybe so, but no matter. You are staying, too.
My mouth fell open, and tears of rage and fear welled up despite myself.
The captain stood up and with some difficulty and stared down at me.
We will see if anyone reports the book stolen.
It may take some days.
During that time, you will have a chance to prove that the book is yours.
But how? I cried.
Easy.
He smiled, but with a shadow of tension.
I have a problem, you see. I have hurt my back. It has hurt for a long time. And yoga, I know, would fix it. And so it's easy, you see. You will show me how to fix my back. And if you succeed, then I will know that you know about yoga and I can believe that the book is yours. Understood? He said with finality. But, I said, Sergeant, he called to the door. Come and lock her up. Chapter 2. Well-being that stays. The sergeant led me roughly by the arm to the middle cell, pushed me inside, barred the door. A moment later, he was back with a stout piece of rope, tied around the dog's neck. He stays with me, I said, trying to muster grandmother's tone of authority, but failing. No dogs in the jail, he answered simply. I stood without moving and glared at him, and then simply cried. It worked a little bit. I'm going to tie him up outside, said the sergeant, trying to sound gruff. You'll be able to see him out the window. He pointed his stick to the back wall, a small window with bars. And food and water? I asked. He looked at me with dark amusement. Same as you, he said simply. He tapped the stick impatiently on the floor, and I realized I was lucky he wasn't just going to kill Long Life. I stooped and tied the rope and told my little lion to go along with all of this. This was not the time for him to be removing chunks of flesh from people's legs. He was calm and seemed to understand. We had been through a lot together, and this was just one more thing to bear for our larger goal, and so he went. I could see him then out the window, and as dusk settled, we discovered a little hole down at the bottom of the wall. I could reach out and just touch Long Life's nose if we were both stretched, but the brick there was covered with filth. I stood up tall at the window and peeked down and saw the little trench dug down the back of the cell, ending in a stagnant pool of stench at the edge of the building, and then realized this was the little hole that was to be my toilet. And I turned and looked back out the front of the cell. The sergeant was still there sitting on the bench, his eyes glued on me mercilessly, with a kind of hunger, the kind he might show for a jar of liquor. And I suddenly saw that this would be the most terrible part of the jail, to be on display, to be stared at all day, all night, by anyone who wished to stare, whether I was awake or sleeping or going to the bathroom. At first I determined that they should never see anything. And then I sat and thought about what my teacher would have done, what Katrin would have done. The words of the master, the words of Patanjali, who thousands of years ago before had written the little book on the captain's desk, they came to my mind in my teacher's voice. And they realize the body itself is a prison. In a way, I thought we are all in prison. A prison from which only death can release us. And these other prisons, well, then they are just a point of view. I had a wonderful chance here to make myself stronger and perhaps to help others, the other people here, including the sergeant, each in a jail of their own. And so I simply laid down on some straw, piled in the corner, and took my rest. I woke at the usual time, before dawn, and I went through my regular morning practices. I had learned a long time before that keeping them up every day was more important than the problems that would always arise to try and stop them. Thankfully, the jail was dark and the only sound was the gentle snoring of the man on the floor in the next cell. At least he wasn't dead. Afterwards, I sat and thought for a while. I thought about the captain and his bad back. I could think of all of this as something terrible, as something that could even cost Long Life and me our lives. Or I could see if perhaps something bigger was happening here. I began to think of the best and fastest way I could help the captain cure his bad back, and it occurred to me that the events had thrust me to the very place I had always said I wanted to go, to an opportunity where I could help others heal themselves, with the knowledge of yoga, the knowledge of the master's little book. And then I caught myself thinking like my teacher, appreciating for the very first time what it must have been like to stand on the other side, looking at a student like myself. It dawned on me suddenly that the job of teaching me, so full of pride and stubbornness, had surely been more difficult than fixing a tired office worker's bad back. And so I began to make some plans. The sun was well up by the time anything stirred in the jail. First, a tall, younger man came through the front door and then simply turned around, leaned against the door frame, and stood there, staring out at the people passing on the road. About 10 minutes later, the captain came up the path and onto the porch. The younger man straightened up sharply, saluted, and then stepped aside respectfully as his superior entered. The captain waved at my cell, "Bring the prisoner to my room." The younger man turned and, with a look of surprise, saw me for the first time. He came and collected me quietly, took me to the captain, and then left and closed the door. "We will begin now," the captain commanded. I nodded. "Please come and stand here," I said, pointing to the middle of the room. He came and stood, and I looked him over silently, as my teacher had me the first day. And then I knew what Katrin had been looking at, because the very way the captain stood there told me everything about his life. His tummy and chin skin were loose, with that look of a person who works at a desk all day. His shoulders were bent in, his neck looked frozen in place from years of tension, trying to please his superiors, wherever they were, and the pain in the back and the pain of his life were making his once gentle features hard and lined. I could see the layers of him, body sagging and locking up, the joints inside stiffening, the inner winds choked at the joints. His thoughts strangling the inner winds, the troubles of his life disturbing his thoughts, and the very source of all the events of his life at the very middle of it all, each one caused by the other, and nothing he could do to stop by himself, because he didn't even know it was happening. But where to start with him? Where would my teacher have started with him? I heard Katrin's voice again, and I spoke the words of the master out loud to the captain, to my very first pupil. The poses bring a feeling of well-being which stays with you. The poses? You mean the exercises, he said. Now that sounds like more like yoga. I smiled. It is where we will begin, at least. Now stand as straight as you can. And I spent an hour just getting him to stand in his body, the way he was meant to stand in his body, the way he had stood in it before his habits had bent and twisted his frame. And then, so he wouldn't think I didn't know anything more, I took him through what we call the bowing to the sun, which left him puffing within a few minutes. At the end, he had a look of accomplishment, the same look I must have had on my first day, I realized, and I knew he deserved it. It takes so much courage just to start, I thought. Now, I want you to do this much every morning for the next week, I said. It's just 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'll go on from there. The poses will fix your back, just like the book says, I nodded pointedly to my book, still in the center of his desk. It will cure your back, and it will cure it for good. The captain nodded happily and sent me back to my cell. Around noon on the first day, a small boy appeared in the doorway of the jail. He was thin and barefoot, dressed in only a ragged pair of shorts. In his hands he held a tray covered with a cloth. He went to one of the rooms on the side and then came back out with the younger policeman. They went to the cell next to mine, and I could hear the door there open, and the boy left. The smell of fresh rice and handmade bread wafted towards me, and I realized Long Life and I hadn't eaten for a day or two. We were used to this on the road, eating only when we found some fruit in the trees, or a stranger who was willing to share some scraps of a meal. But the smell was overwhelming. I waited for my own meal to come, and then suddenly realized there would be no meal. And just as suddenly, a hand reached around the corner from the other cell and pushed a small cup of rice and beans in between the bars toward me. "Eat," a voice whispered from the other side of the wall. "Fast, and then push the cup back. And for heaven's sake, don't let the sergeant see you." I gulped the food down, setting aside a good part to hand through to Long Life, and I got the cup back just before the sergeant's shadow loomed in the front door. Chapter 3. A Reason Not to Skip. It always surprises me how fast we get used to something. The days passed, and I made good use of them, settling down into a routine of yoga and silent mental review of the lessons that Katrin had taught me. And so it was as if I'd gone on a retreat, which I suppose I had. Life in the dirty little jail outside was dull,
only an occasional farmer coming to report a stolen cow, things like that. The cups from the other side of the wall came silently every day, always right after one of the young boys delivered a fresh tray next door. It was just barely enough for Long Life and me, and the younger policeman left me a small jug of water each morning. I handed palmfuls out through the filthy hole to Long Life, who was panting from the heat, tied to a barren tree. Long before, I had cut his luxurious hair short so he could travel better in the Indian sun, but he was still suffering. The next class with the captain was exactly a week from the first. He had brought me into his office, and I asked him to repeat what he had learned. After a minute or two, I could see that he had missed 3, maybe even 4 days of practice. I stopped him. "You've been skipping your practice," I said firmly. "And the master says in my book over there on your desk that your practice must be steady without gaps." "I didn't skip my practice," he replied in a voice that said he was unaccustomed to being challenged. But I knew I had to press the point now or he would never be healed. "You did," I repeated. "I can see it as plain as day, the way you can probably look into a criminal's eyes and see whether he's done something wrong or not." "Well, I mean to say," the captain cleared his throat, "that I didn't skip a day. I have found it necessary to not do my practice on a day." "On a day?" I smiled wryly, with a little pang in my heart, for I suddenly recalled Katrine saying the same words to me with the same smile. Perhaps it was more than that, he allowed. "Then you must give me my book back now and let me leave," I said evenly. "Your back will never be healed. If you won't practice steadily, a little every day, the master himself says." And the fifth of the obstacles is laziness. The captain's face clouded. He snapped up straight with his usual grimace. "I was not lazy," he retorted. "I am not a lazy person. I was working, pressing work. I have responsibilities, you know." "Always that?" I answered coolly. "Always that? Always something important you had to do?" He paused and thought it over. "Oh, and one day, I think it was one day, I just wasn't in the mood, you see. Stretching, bending, groaning, all of that, a man my age with responsibilities." "Enough," I smiled, holding up my hand. "I've heard all of this before."
"You have?" He looked at me intently. "You have taught others? I thought I might be your first."
"Oh, not that I've heard these excuses from others," I laughed. "It's just that I tried to use all of them when my own teacher, and I know what they are. They are just plain laziness. Laziness. Don't call it anything more noble. Something else comes up and the yoga takes a little effort. It takes time, and so you skip it. You don't really want to do it. You don't really want to heal your back. You should just let me go." "But I do want it. I do want to be healed. It hurts, you know." He put his hand to his back and looked down at the floor with sadness. "It all hurts. I really thought you could help." We stood there quiet for a while. I looked at him standing like that in his sadness. It came to me that perhaps he was ready for a bigger step, a step that would take him a long way if he would really try it. "Captain, sir, I believe you. I believe that you really want to be healed." He looked up and gazed at me gently with a kind of gratitude. "And so I will tell you something now, something special. It is a little early to tell you, but if you follow it sincerely, you will be able to practice steadily. You will not skip your practice, and then it will work." He nodded. "Then tell me. I will try." I nodded back. "In the book, the master says again, 'And if you wish to stop these obstacles, there is one and only one crucial practice for doing so.'"
"And what is it?" he asked.
"And then the master says, 'You must use compassion.'" The captain turned and gazed out the window. "Compassion? What's that supposed to mean? How would that stop me from skipping my practice?" "It's something you have to understand," I said quietly. "It's something important. You see, you can't do this. You can't do yoga just to fix your own back. It's too small. We are too small." If we do something just to help ourselves, it will never work. You can never really put effort into a thing if it's only for yourself. It has to be for something bigger. Bigger? Like what? Look at the way a woman will work for her children. Look at the work they can do. Mothers, 24 hours a day, day in, day out, for 10, 20 years. It puts your little office work to shame. And they can do it for only one reason, because they are not doing it only for themselves. They are doing it for others too. The captain laughed. So you want me to do my yoga for other people too? Are you telling me I won't be able to fix my back unless I figure out how to fix a couple of other backs along the way? Something like that, I said. All you really have to do is think about helping some other people with what you learn. If I taught you all this yoga and suddenly your back got better and you were walking around with a big smile on your face all the time, would it do anything, say, for the sergeant or for that younger policeman? You mean the corporal? The captain smiled. I don't know. It would take a lot to get him to do anything. He never has any energy. He never gets excited about anything. He eats a pile of his mother's buttered flatbreads, fills up that little pot belly, and strolls to work. Then he stands at the door and stares out at nothing all day. The captain paused. But could yoga do anything for him? Do you think it could give him some pep or interest in life? It does a lot of things, I replied. A lot of things you could hardly guess. But yes, certainly it would change his life. I paused myself so he'd listen to what came next. But you see, in a way, now that he knows you've started yoga, he'll wait and see if it helps you. If it obviously does, then we could get him to change himself. And so you see, if you have compassion, if you keep thinking that if you fix your back, you might be also fixing the corporal, and then when a day comes that you feel like skipping your practice, you won't, because you'd be hurting him too, you see? The captain mulled this over, but I could see the idea might not be clear enough in his heart to work. And just then, the door to his office burst open, and there was the sergeant, panting for breath, his face red and contorted from his liquor. "Oh," he exclaimed, "sorry, sir. Didn't know you were occupied." He stood there stupidly, weaving in the doorway, leering at the two of us. "That, too?" said the captain quietly to me. "Same thing," I replied. He nodded. "I won't forget." And then, "Sergeant, could you help the prisoner back to her cell?" Chapter 4. A Balance of Feelings. More days flew by. Long Life's rope stretched out, and he could get up closer to the little hole, and I could scratch his head a bit. I began to work out the schedule kept by my three captors. The captain followed typical office hours, wandering in by mid-morning, doing some work, taking a long lunch, then talking with a few friends who came, taking tea, a touch of work, then off to home again. The sergeant and the corporal divided up the day, and one always slept in the side room at night. One night there was a little commotion. Someone banged on the front door and woke up the sergeant, and he had to leave with them, barring the door on the way out. A few minutes later, there was a tap from the cell next door. "Girl," the man said. "Girl, are you awake?" I was a little stunned. I had given up hope of having anyone to talk to. "Yes, yes, I am." "Good, good. We should talk a bit. But careful you listen well for the door. The prisoners are absolutely forbidden to talk, and the sergeant will flail the skin off our backs with that idiot stick if he catches us. Got it?" "Oh, yes," I said. Then suddenly I was at a loss for words. "What's your name?" he whispered. It dawned on me that no one had even asked me my name yet. "Why, it's Friday," I whispered back. "My name is Friday." "Born on a Friday, yes?" he whispered. "Yes, that and more." "Well, I'm Busuku," he whispered back, stretching out the sounds. "Busuku." "Busuku," I said. "Sounds like a nice name. Does it have a meaning?" "Oh, yes," he replied with a chuckle. "It means Mr. Worthless."
I guess a lot of people figure I'm the most worthless person in this worthless little town.
Well, I don't think so. I don't know how we would have done without you sharing food.
We?
Oh, you're giving some to the dog. Oh, yes, but he's not just a dog, you see.
I understand.
So I'll send a bit more, but we have to talk. And then the front door burst open and I could see the sergeant's form there, and we froze. But he just mumbled something to himself and stumbled to his room, and all was quiet again. The next time the captain called me in, he remained at his little desk and waved me to the mat on the floor in front of him.
Something's wrong, he said.
What's that?
Well, I did what you said, what the book said. What you say the book said. Anyway, I've been able to practice every single day except my day off. He looked up at me like a schoolboy to see if he was in trouble.
A day off is fine, I said. That's not skipping. If you choose a regular day off or two of the week, the rest of your practice and the rest of the week you practice, that's perfect.
Yes, well, I'm glad. I thought so. And you're right. Just thinking of the corporal and the sergeant.
He stopped suddenly and turned and gazed out the window for a moment and then turned back and looked at me. They are in such pain, you know, just normal people trying to live their lives. Everybody has something. It took me a long time to realize that, and so thinking I might help them even a little, well, it has worked, you know. I haven't skipped. But now I don't think it's going to work.
Why not?
Well, you see, once I started to do the yoga every day, even just a little every day, well, then you see I started to hurt all over. Oh, my bones, you see, my knees and my arms, sometimes my back, they make these popping sounds when I do the exercises. And so, you see, maybe I'm different. It's maybe just not going to work for me. He looked a little crestfallen.
Popping sounds, I said, little cracking sounds as if you were cracking your fingers.
Just so, he exclaimed.
I smiled.
That's very normal, especially for a man your age.
The joints between the bones, you see, especially in your knees or your neck or your back or shoulders, they have been freezing up more and more each year. You probably hardly noticed it. And now we are opening them back up, releasing little places where the inner winds have locked up. And it makes that little sound. But you should let me know right away if anything else happens that actually hurts.
He nodded, but his mind had gone.
Inner winds? He asked.
Later, I replied, later. Right now, you should be happy when you hear that noise. And as the joints open and the winds begin to flow again, it will go away. You won't even notice when it does.
But what about the rest? He insisted. You're supposed to be fixing me. But I get up out of bed and I walk to the station like a duck. I'm so sore.
I laughed again just to imagine. I had bothered my teacher, too, with all this silly talk.
Almost the very same words.
You are sore, I said, because you are waking up muscles that have slept a long time. And if you don't wake them up, your back will never get better. That's what holds your back up in the first place, those muscles. And when you feel a little sore like this, I want you to remember something else from the master's short book on yoga. It says,
learn to keep your feelings in balance, whether something feels good or whether it hurts.
The point is, there are going to be days when you feel a little sore, and other days when you suddenly make a breakthrough and it feels great. That's just the way it is, peaks and valleys. That's the way everything is, and you have to try not to get too discouraged and not to get too excited, because for the time being, things like this will continue to go up and down. You can't let it distract you. You have a goal. You have your two men to think of.
The captain straightened up and stood up. He did look sore as he stood up, but he didn't wince, although he didn't notice that.
He came and I took him through his paces, adding some standing poses like the triangle to begin building up some strength throughout his body. In one way or another, it would help his back. When we finished, he was sweating, but looked invigorated in his heart as well as his face. He stood there for a minute before sending me back to my cell.
Something you said, he remarked.
Yes?
You said things would go, that they would continue to go up and down, but then you said, for the time being. What's that supposed to mean?
It's coming, I smiled, something Katrin always used to say to me. Chapter 5. Doing It Right.
People think jails are bad because you can't go outside. But I guess if you could ask all the prisoners there ever were, the worst thing about being behind bars would have to be the ticks, with the fleas running a close second, and then the occasional visitors like rats and jungle cockroaches. The floor was just too cold not to sleep on the pile of hay, but the hay, that's where the ticks slept too. It wasn't too bad while I was asleep, just a little itching here and there that sent my dreams off in odd detours. But then, when the sunlight started to filter in through the window, I'd see two or three of the ticks hanging on the wall, where they seemed to prefer to do their digesting, bloated into little red sacks the size of a thumbnail, gorged with my blood. And then I'd get rashes that the fleas would find, and both Long Life and I spent a good deal of our time just sitting and scratching. The captain called me in a few days early, which I'd expected. He was starting to feel better, although he still hadn't noticed it himself, and now he was regular at his practice, and he began to take a little well-deserved pride in it. I watched with satisfaction as he went through his routine, still only about 10 minutes of it. But then he reached something called the Western Stretch, where you sit on the floor with your legs stretched out and try to hold your toes. Captain, wait. Stop. He glanced up at me, his cheek grazing his knee. Stop? This is one of my best poses. Yes, best, because you're not doing it right. Certainly not, he exclaimed, sitting up. Why, I can already touch my head to my knees. Touch it to your knees, yes, but only because you are cheating. Your knees are bent nearly in half. I told you they have to be straight. Now the master says, master says, master says. Doesn't the master ever say I did anything right, he whined. The master says, I repeated with a grin, recalling my tussles with Katrin, your practice must be done correctly, for then a firm foundation is laid. You see, the point is not what the poses look like on the outside to someone watching you, the captain touching his head to his knees. It's the process of the pose as it goes on. It's what it does inside of you, how it works to begin to straighten and open your channels. Channels? He asked. Later, I said, feeling more and more like grumpy old Katrin. But if you don't do the poses in alignment, if you cheat, if you try to trick the pose and get around it just so it looks good, then the pose doesn't work on you the way it's supposed to. Now try it again, without bending your knees. The captain moaned, but stuck out his legs once more. He reached his hands forward toward the vicinity of his shins and then curled his back up like a little tortoise to plop his head on his knees. No, 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 I cried, giving his back a little slap, something Katrin would have done to me dozens of times a day. He was up on his feet in a flash, red in the face, glaring at me. Why, you, but, what are you doing, you girl? I may be a girl, but I'm still your teacher. You did it wrong again. You did the same thing again. You cheated it. But this time, you may have hurt yourself. I told you the back has to be straight. It must be straight. And you bend at the hips. That's how you get into the pose, like a hinge, never a curl. Your lower back suffers when you curl. You'll hurt it. You'll hurt it more. You have to learn to listen to me. You have to do the poses in alignment, just like the master says. He stayed there for a moment, his eyes on me with anger, and then finally let his breath out in a huge sigh. All right. Look, suppose I do it your way, he said, sitting down again. I stick my legs out very straight. No cheating, you see, he exclaimed, holding up his arms. So far, so good. And now I keep my back very straight, he bellowed, and I fold at my hips like a hinge. And then he bent forward. It looked great. But you see, he cried, you see? See what? I said. He pointed to his forehead and then touched his knees and held his hands out frustrated. My head is a good 2 feet from my knees. That's all fine, I said. It's what you can do now. It'll change if you do it right. And that lays a firm foundation to build from, healing your back all along the way. We are here to make you healthy again, not make sure you can touch your head to your knees. The captain shrugged, a little put out, but then he did the pose right. He really was an intelligent and sensitive man, no matter how hard he tried to hide it. I gave him some more seated poses to bring his back along slowly, and then some gentle twists at the waist, warning him to do only a few, exactly as I'd shown him. At the end, I had him lie quietly and rest for a while in a pose of perfect stillness and quiet, so still that we call it the dead man's pose. And when he sat up again, he had a question for me. But you know, he said, I've watched you do some of the poses, and I know that even if I try, I can't really do them right, not the way you do them. Oh yes, I know. It's one of the paradoxes of yoga. To really do a pose right, you have to be okay with doing it a little wrong 1,000 times. So you can say that doing a pose wrong helps you do a pose right, he concluded cheerfully. Not if what you're doing is wrong as out of alignment and your teacher has corrected you, I shot back at him, the way Katrine would have to me. And then he sent me to my cell. Chapter 6, The Harassment of Preferences. For over a month in the dirty little jail, I'd worked out small routines to deal with things that you just take for granted elsewhere, like washing. My dress was sticky with dust and sweat, and I had developed an odor that I could smell, even over the stink of the trench outside my window. The sergeant didn't seem to have any intention of allowing me enough water to wash myself, and I still found him staring at me in that way that was frightening, especially when he was really drunk. It was as though he was pushing things, waiting for something to happen. But I figured out a way to take a tiny bit of water each day, set it in a little depression in the back corner of the cell, where it was cooler, and cover it with hay. After a few days of this, I had a large cupful there, and then at night, when everything was dark and quiet, I'd wash a part of me or a little section of my dress. Underneath, I always wore a special white cotton loincloth that the sages of the way of yoga wear, something I'd gotten from my uncle, one of the greatest Tibetan masters of his art. And so when I washed the dress, I always had that on and the shawl around my top, just in case the sergeant came out. Long life was getting more and more filthy, tormented by the fleas and lack of any freedom to move, although he never complained. I spent a lot of time making up different impossible schemes to help him. That week, when I went to see the captain, he was really coming along quite well, considering how new he was to yoga. He went through the series I'd given him, careful this time to do things the right way, even if it was a little bit slower, or he couldn't get all the way into something. I let him go to the end in peace, because sometimes a student needs that too. After he had rested and let his body warm down, he sat up and looked at me with a big smile. I'm getting much better, aren't I? Oh, yes. Yes, you are. And we can both see it. I want to thank you for working so well, so consistently, a little each day, and I know your back is coming along, and I know the other two men can see it too. And so you have nothing to complain about today? Nothing to make up a quotation from the master about? I don't make them up, and I think you know that by now. He gazed at me thoughtfully. Perhaps. Time will tell. And so you're saying you've memorized the whole book? I nodded. Then we were quiet for a while. And then, just to make sure his confidence didn't slip into cockiness, I added, there was one small thing, though. The captain scowled a bit, but didn't lose his good mood. Okay, let's hear it. Everything you did well, but you skipped something. You skipped a boat pose. He made a face. In fact, this is one pose that everybody makes that face about. It's hard to sit there, stretch out your legs, hold your feet up in the air while your teacher goes through a very slow count. That one's a real pain, he said. I start puffing and my stomach feels like someone's walking on it. I think it's just something about me, the way my particular body is built. I'm sure other people find it helpful and easier to do, but it's certainly not for me. So I've just decided to leave it out. Anyway, it saves some time, and I've certainly got enough work to do with all these other poses. Not the point, Captain. The poses I give you have a special order and a special purpose to the order. Each pose balances every other pose, and the effect on you and your back flows in a certain way, building towards a certain goal. When you leave even just one pose out, you disrupt that flow, and you hurt that goal in ways that you cannot realize. He held his eyes on me. He really was improving, in the most important way, in his attitude. No petulant objections this time, and so I knew I could take him a little deeper. And the master says. Ah, the master says. I knew it. But he said it with a smile. I smiled back too. The master says, in the short book, and there will come a time when differences no longer harass you. Differences? He said. Differences, I repeated. But differences, first of all, in the sense of preferences. As you get further and further along with your yoga, especially as the channels begin to open and the inner winds can flow better. Channels? Inner winds again? Later, I said. So as you get better and deep inside your energy begins to flow better, then things begin to tend towards unity and less towards difference. Things? What things? Well, everything, actually, I replied. But right now, we're talking about the poses and fixing your back. And you can get to that further, faster, if you try to tone down your preferences. Try to bring the differences between the poses closer together. That does a lot for your inner winds, and that does a lot for your back. And I really do promise I'll explain all of that for you very soon. So right now, you have to attack your whole routine of poses with the same enthusiasm, with the same joy about why you're doing them, all of them. It's all for the drunken wreck and the diehard lazy bones. I know. He was joking, but then I knew he was really keeping the others in mind, and my heart leaped. If he kept this up, the whole thing might work out after all. I nodded. Right. So you see, no pose is less important than another. Some are easier for you, some are harder. Everyone's different in that way. But you have to come to each one with an open heart, knowing it brings you a little closer towards helping those other people we talked about. And this, again, is why your yoga will only succeed if you do it for something bigger than yourself. So no more faces when you come to a pose that's hard for you. The hard ones are usually doing your back the best good. Don't give in to preferences. Don't create more differences in your life. It's the differences that harass us all day long, that make our days unhappy. I like this. I don't like that. I like her. Don't like him. I don't want to do this. I'd rather do that. We paused there, and he nodded like a good soldier and almost bowed his head to me. But then the sergeant, with his sickly breath, was pulling me back by the arm to my cell. I chanced to peek at my neighbor Busuku, whom I'd never really seen. He was there, sitting in the corner, a short man with broad, bald head, cheerful belly. He gave me a bold, happy wink as we passed.